I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Ivan Coyote joins me again, the storyteller and author, and now the Alice Munro Chair in Creativity at Western University in London, Ontario. He's also a guest curator at this year's Vancouver Writers' Fest. I'll ask Ivan about their role in curating four events. As well, I'll check in with them about what these past few months have been like because of COVID. As you'll hear in this conversation from this past weekend, I laughed and cried laughing. Ivan is a marvelous author and an award-winning one at that, most recently the inaugural recipient of the Jim Diva Prize for Writing That Provokes from the recent BC and Yukon Book Prizes for their recent book, Rebent Sinner. Visit IvanCoyote.com for more information on Ivan's distinguished career as a writer and performer, and visit writersfest.bc.ca for information on the over 40 events at the Vancouver Writers' Fest that begins Monday, the 19th of October, and that runs until Sunday, the 25th of October. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Ivan Coyote. Ivan, good morning.
Hi, Joseph. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Good. Do you prefer Joe or Joseph?
I prefer either. Joe, okay. Joe's fine, so yeah.
All right. Okay.
I don't usually ask people how they are because I find that's the hardest question I'll ever ask a guest. But in this year of 2020, it seems like the only question one ought to ask whenever you encounter someone again.
Yeah, for sure. I hear you on that. And then you're faced with, how do you answer that?
Yeah.
How am I? Lately, I've been kind of going, well, there's sort of two how am I's. One is like the outside world, how am I?
Sure, yeah.
And then there's the sort of within these four walls and under this roof, how am I?
Yeah.
And I imagine that all of our outside how am I's are, you know, anxious, keeping an eye on the looming election, watching the rise of fascism globally, south of the border and within our own border here, sort of keeping an eye and an ear and listening and learning and reading about what I'm starting to call the reckoning,
yeah,
the great reckoning of 2020. That's my outside, how am I? And my inside, how am I? Is I'm okay. I'm all right. I'm in London, Ontario. I started a job at Western in July.
Uh-huh.
It's a two-year term on the Alice Munro Chair in Creativity. I'm staying at my partner's house. She happened to live in London. That's one of the reasons I applied for the job here.
Uh-huh.
And I was here in London when, on the road, I was just going to have a quick two-day visit before continuing on tour in March when everything kind of went sideways. And, you know, we're okay. I've got the fridge is stocked and the garden's just about put away for winter, and I'm working away, and, you know, we're okay. We're both healthy. We've managed to dodge the virus so far, and we've got the little dog here, and, so those are your two answers.
Yeah, I guess we're all good until we're not, and then we're all good considering everything else that's happening. I guess those would be my answers, say. Are there things that you've done over the last few months that have helped keep you grounded, say, sane even? I mean, I guess that's what we're asking each other whenever we encounter one another, is how are we coping through all of this?
Yeah, I was a gym goer. That's one of the things I used to do.
Mm.
Well, one thing I've always done when I got home from the road was cook, so I've done a lot of cooking.
Yeah.
I had a lot of meal preparation and, you know, continued on with that. And then when the gyms all shut down, that was tough for a while. So Sarah used to train as a boxer, and so she had a couple of skipping ropes in a suitcase downstairs, and we dug those out. And somewhere around the end of March, we started skipping
mm-hmm.
rope every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to take a little break because I was having some foot pain. But I think I'm back in the saddle again with the skipping rope, and that it's actually a really decent workout, and it was something that I, as a sort of a tomboy, I guess I sort of bucked the my early, you know, the early pressure to skip rope. It seemed like a thing that girls did in the in the street outside, and so I sort of turned my nose up stupidly in retrospect at it when I was younger, and so I was just a horrific skipper at the beginning. I could barely do two or three, and now I'm doing double unders, and I can skip backwards and crossovers. And like I said, I had to take a little hiatus because of impact on my feet, and my 51-year-old feet. But so skipping rope is one thing, and then I was working on a mystery novel actually when the pandemic hit. I was taking a break from memoir, sort of for nonfiction based stuff, and working on this mystery novel set, partly in 1985 and partly in 2020, and it was sort of loosely inspired by a thing that went down in real life in my little small town of Whitehorse in 1985, which was that my neighbor, two doors down, disappeared. He disappeared. He went out to the bar one night, I think got stoned with his friends and dropped acid was the story, actually, and got up to use the bathroom at some point, they thought, and they just never saw him again. And they found his remains 11 years later in what may or may not have been a shallow grave. And that was a real, as many people who, you know, have something like that happen, like in their close vicinity or in their family when they're young, had a big impression on me as a kid. And I always knew that somehow I was going to not write about that incident but write about the phenomenon that happened between myself and my peer group at that time. When this sort of thing went down. So anyways, I was working on this mystery novel, and then I was still okay with the 1985 part, but the 2020 part, I didn't know how to write about this reality. Reality was so just so vastly different and shifting and changing. And remember when we were all like Lysoling down our groceries every day? And
that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, doing 3 weeks worth of shopping all at once. Uh-huh. And, we didn't really know too much about transmit. Anyways, back in the old days of the pandemic, which is funny, we laugh at it, but it makes the point I'm talking about, which is that everything was changing so quickly. I didn't know how to, you know, and in my story, they find his remains. They found them in real life, in the mid to late 90s. In my story, they find the remains in the present day.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't bring myself to write about the present day. So I kind of put that project on hold, and I started answering mail. I've kept this file of letters since about 2008 or 2009, special emails. I think it's even called special letters.
Yeah.
And I also had a hard copy folder as well of letters, snail mail I'd been sent, letters I'd been passed at shows.
Mm-hmm.
Notes from kids. Sometimes teachers, when I would do a school show, they would force the kids to write me a feedback letter. Most of the time they were like, thank you for coming to our school. But every once in a while there was a real gem of a letter from those kids. And there was even a note that was tucked under my windshield wiper of my car one time when I got back to the parking lot behind the theater. Anyway, started answering all those letters.
Well, you know, your publicist sent me, I read Rebent Sinner about a year or so ago when it came out, and I loved the book, and you know that how much I enjoyed that book and was moved by it. So I was reading it again last night, and I was going to ask you, because people do write you letters.
Yeah.
And you answer some of the negative letters in the book. There are a couple, I think, you do. I was going to ask you, what is that like? You just mentioned that you have this file that's been going on for years now, so you're catching up on that. So you do get a lot of letters, and it would be tiring, I would think, to have to answer every single one of them, especially if they were not altogether pleasant.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's why there was a backlog, because there's two kinds of letters. Well, there's all kinds of letters, but there's two kinds of letters that require you to sort of take a breath and take some time to respond.
Yeah.
And those fall loosely into two categories, which is one is like real negative letters, or like on the surface anyway, sort of negative letters. And then the really special letters, the ones where something I wrote or a show that I did or some kind of connection that I made with another human via art and work and books and stories really resonated with that person or moved them or you know, shook loose their own story,
yeah.
rattled their ghosts, I call it actually.
Yeah.
And, so I think in terms of Rebent Sinner, you're thinking of the letter from the spiritual redneck
right.
and the letter from the teacher.
Yeah.
So both of those letters required me to really take, because they were on the surface anyway, kind of negative, the one to the spiritual redneck, it took me 2 years and 2 months, I think it was, 10 days or something like that.
Really?
To actually write the guy back, because I don't think he meant it that way, but at me as the person, there were so many deeply, deeply disturbing and offensive assumptions made and questions asked by him, you know, and all of that's, of course, in the letter itself, which is also in the book. And so, you know, it took a lot of, I really had to sit on that letter to sort of muster up the compassion and the patience to answer him in a way that felt like I was calling him in, I guess, instead of dismissing him altogether.
Yeah. So then, when you write back to people in that way, say, do you hear back from them again?
Sometimes, sometimes not.
Yeah.
I didn't hear back from the spiritual redneck. I did hear back from the teacher. Where I wrote sort of letter. Remember the one she was asking me about statistics to sort of back up my lived reality? I did hear back from her, and she was, and I even said, I'm sending you this letter, like, please take it with the sort of tongue in cheek, like gentle ripping that I'm giving you as the letter writer. And she was really offended and sort of backtracked out of what she had asked me.
Huh.
Sort of said, that's not what I asked you at all, but I mean, I had it all there in the letter.
Yeah.
And, she was not impressed at all. And then I've been, like I said, all these letters I've been writing back this summer, I've heard back from almost all of them, waiting on a response from a 19-year-old kid in Australia. But his letter, I had sent him a very brief response about 3 years ago, and then I finally wrote him a big Iliad. And so either he doesn't know how to respond to receiving a big Iliad, or maybe he's changed his email address since then. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I sometimes hear back, sometimes I don't. And, you know, I've always liked writing letters. I learned from my grandmother. She was a fantastic letter writer, Patricia, on my dad's side.
Yeah.
And I've still got a giant box full of her letters I have to go through when I get back to Vancouver. And I've got, and that's correspondence from going back way back in her life, and then also letters from me in there too. And she wrote. So, you know, it's always been a part of my, like I would even say art practice to write letters. There's something, I don't know, there's something very, Judith Butler just did a really interesting interview. I don't know if you saw her going around social media, where she makes reference to long conversations and slow conversations. And I, to me, that's how I see letters. I see them as a very long and slow conversation.
Yeah.
And really changes the kind of, it's the antithesis of the Twitter exchange.
Exactly.
Is a long, carefully thought out, pondered letter.
And I still print out, like if I get emails from people, I still print them out and I put them in a file just to keep them, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they're just important to me as, say a card or a letter that I would get through the post or something, because I think you are absolutely right. They are well thought out sometimes, and they deserve to be read again.
Yeah, most of them. And then there's hate mail that
sure,
I just dismiss. You know, out of hand, and if I get any threats or anything like that, then they go into a special file, like, you know, just to keep a paper trail in case
Indeed.
They escalate. And,
Indeed.
Yeah.
So for people listening, as we've been talking about two letters in a book called Rebent Sinner, which recently won the Jim Diva Prize at the BC and Yukon Book Prizes. Congratulations on that. It's a tremendous book, and it's enjoyable, and it'll get your eyes wet, and it'll make you laugh out loud. And the thing that, as I was rereading it last night, I know writing is work, and hard work at times, but when I read your work, not just in this book, but in Tomboy Survival Guide, at one point it seems effortless, and I'm wondering, when you write, sure, it can be hard, but does it come easy sometimes for you?
Yes and no. I'm a follower of what Patrick Lane used to call the ass in chair method of writing.
Yeah.
So sometimes those points where as a reader it might feel effortless, I'm not sure, of course, because it's a very personal thing, what point in the book that it might feel like that to you. For me, I suspect those are the points in the writing process where I was really in a groove. I was off work, and I was practiced, I was honed, which meant that I had been following my ass in chair method and was, my at home sort of really focused on a project. Word count minimum is 1,000 words a day.
Really?
So I think those places where the writing feels effortless as a reader they're the places where I've gotten really in what musicians call in the pocket.
Yeah.
Which means I'm practiced. I've been writing, cranking out 1,000 to 2,000 words a day more than a few days in a row. And I think those are the points where I managed to turn off the editor in my head completely and just really get in a groove with it. And I would suspect there's a crossover between those places that you say as the reader feel effortless. And so, yes, they're easier, but they're easier because you've practiced. So it's not like they're effortless. It's a point of where the most effort has paid off in a writerly way.
If that
makes any sense.
Yeah, no, there's some beautiful moments in the book. And a couple that I'm thinking of are, you're just describing something you saw as you were walking down the street, say, or something that you heard, overheard people talking about. The beauty of that moment, whether it's funny or poignant or sad even, the beauty of that is in that moment, and yet you've taken that and described it so beautifully to us who obviously weren't there and are now a witness to it. And that's what I just reveled in as I was reading the book, just enjoying how you're able to capture these moments, these beautiful moments. So I guess effortlessly is the word. There's probably a better word than that, but so well, you know.
Well, thanks, Joe. I mean, I guess that's what we're all kind of going for, is those places in the writing where sort of posing or artifice or like anything contrived kind of falls back, and you're able to find that.
Yeah, get what you need out of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, find that spot where the words just find themselves around what the image was in your head, you know.
You write in the in your note in the program for the Writers Fest that you first appeared there as an author 18 years ago, and I'm sure you've had wonderful interactions with readers and other writers over the years. What has the Writers Festival, what has that meant to you, not just as a writer, but as a reader?
Whenever I'm in town, whether I'm got a book out, usually you're going to hit the Writers Festival when you've got a new book out. So, you know, every other year, every third year, every fourth year for me, depending on, you know, how much work I was managing to get done. So I generally go every year, whether I'm a writer or not, like whether I'm a programmed.
Yeah.
I'm always a writer. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Whether I'm a part of the actual festival or just attending as a listener or a reader, I always go. And I think one of the most genius things that the Writers Festival, and you know, I guess that would have been Alma Lee back in the day, did was to have it all happen almost exclusively on Granville Island.
Yeah.
So what happens is you become this village of readers, and it's not just about being in the audience at the performance works or at the Granville Island Theater or at the arts club.
Yeah.
It's about all those moments in between, like walking around back and forth, and you go for a coffee, and then you run into so-and-so, and then, you know, and then you see someone outside, and you end up going for dinner together, and so for me it was that kind of like just having several days to you know, the writing practice itself is often very solitary,
mm-hmm.
and touring for me is often very solitary, unless I'm doing like touring with a theater project and I have a band with me or something like that, but most of the time I'm on the road by myself. And even at other festivals and other places, you know, I've just arrived, and you know, the longer you're on the road, the less money you make. Not to be too crass about it, but
yeah.
I don't take that kind of time that I get with the Vancouver Writers Festival because I live in Vancouver.
Yeah.
To really have a chance to enjoy, like, sit there for 3 days when I only have one event and go see 6 other events, you know.
Yeah.
And I should, but it's exhausting, and so the Vancouver Writers Festival has been special for me in that way, that it's the one festival where I really get the time to sit in the audience just as much, or if not more, than I do be on the stage, you know.
Yeah, and the growth as a writer, your growth over 18 years, I mean, that's sort of run parallel to the growth of this festival. I mean, we all wondered what was going to happen this year, but it just seems like a fit. The Vancouver Writers Fest going online, that it's not going to be the same, but the community is still there, right?
You know, it's hard to say at the beginning of the festival how it's all going to shake down, of course, but I can say, you know, I've known Clea for years, who works at the festival. Leslie, I've worked with now for a couple years, as a writer and as a festival goer as well, interacting with her curation, and then now as the guest curator. I still feel a lot of the same drive, a lot of the same, just coming from the same place of just a real love of books and authors and a real care and kind attention paid to the writers, and you know, I still see all of those same things. I mean, there's a huge part of me this year who I feel a bit a lot of the things that first motivated me to say yes when Leslie asked me to be the guest curator have been sort of stolen from me. Like, I, you know,
yeah.
The receptions and the sitting outside, standing outside in the probably rain with the writers who still smoke cigarettes and sneaking down to the marina with Brian Brett to smoke a joint and then washing my hands so I don't reek too much like weed when I go into the to the what do they call it, the quarter deck or whatever.
Yeah.
The writer's lounge.
Uh-huh.
All of those things are, you know, and this year I was going to, I would have probably flown in because I would have been in, I'm in London, so I would have stayed at the hotel with all the other writers who are staying at the hotel. And, you know, I don't know, have you ever been to that thing that they do at Performance Works, the opening night, and they had the, like, last year, I think it was, like, prawns and scallops, pan-fried.
No, I always seem to miss it. I get the invitation, but then I always miss it because I've got something. But I always hear about it later.
You should not miss that. I mean,
yeah.
I feel really ripped off about the prawns. I mean, yes, I'm going to also miss seeing my colleagues and my friends.
Sure,
writers.
Yeah.
But there's a big part of me that's really, really pining for the... You're really, really pissed off that I'm not going to get the prawns and scallops deal that they do now.
And the seafood in London is not as good as it is on this coast, is it?
No comment.
Would you tell us about what you're looking forward to, and especially about the events that you've curated? Because I'm you mentioned Patrick Lane a moment ago, and I just remembered that Lorna Crozier will be at an event that you're hosting on, I believe it's Tuesday the 20th, is that right?
It is, yeah. It's called A Recipe for Anything, and it's kind of, I guess my approach to curation this year was to... I approached it with an artist's heart, and I approached it as a writer who, not always, but sometimes when I'm programmed into a festival, I feel like there's a theme that I maybe loosely fit into some way. I'm thinking specifically about doing a gig on northern writers in Australia one time, and I think it was me, Elizabeth Hay, and Sheila Watts Cluche, who wrote, wrote that book, The Right to be Cold.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So the three of us, and, you know, one's about Yellowknife, one's about northern Canada and global warming, and then Tomboy Survival Guide. And we were all sort of crammed in because we were in Australia from Canada, and we were all from the north. But our books were very... vastly different,
yeah.
And really had nothing in common other than the place, sort of the place that the authors were created in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I just tried to really, I just tried to bring together writers whose work moved me, and then make it loose enough, make the theme or the idea loose enough that the writers could find their own way into however they wanted or chose to talk about their work.
Yeah.
And so Lorna comes up because she's just published this beautiful memoir of her time with Patrick Lane, and they are where Patrick was, and Lorna continues to be very, very dear friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
As well. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that with Cicely Bell Blaine, Jillian Christmas, and Andrea Bennett, the other three writers for that. As part of my four events, they asked me to do two YA events. That's the event with David Robertson and A.S. King and Sybil Lamb.
Mm.
And then the YA stuff, I wanted to push the envelope a little bit, and especially since we're online, and kind of like do something that broke the box of the sort of appropriate for the grade 11s getting bussed on to the Granville Island sort of thing, which is great. But so I programmed the Tegan and Sarah to come and talk about their book, which is called High School, and which is definitely sort of not safe for high school. I know Tegan and Sarah from just the art scene, I guess, in Vancouver.
Uh-huh.
I remember talking to their mom at an event, and she, before that book came out, and she was going to therapy to emotionally prepare herself to read the manuscript of what her twin daughters were actually up to during their high school years. So So it's kind of like, you know, an acid-fueled... you know, tape on high school. So that, and I thought that that one would kind of bring in some, a younger audience that might not have showed up to a writer's festival.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's sort of, that was the deal with the Tegan and Sarah event at the high school event. Yeah.
One of the things that I admire, I mean, there are a lot of things about you that I admire, but one of the things is, as a performer, you're able to connect, your ability to connect, I should say, with, I was going to say regular audiences, but say adult audiences, as well as sort of younger audiences, because you're in schools a lot, or were, before before the pandemic. When you're performing for, because they're two different audiences, essentially. They're not really, but you know what I mean. Does the whatever you feel as a performer, does that change?
High school gigs are, they're like, I call it storytelling on the edge.
Mm.
It's, if you, as a performer, can, it's like getting thrown to the lions. Not to be too dramatic about it, but it, but sometimes I'm even in a gymnasium where they have, where, like, that's set up, like, sort of for floor hockey.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And they, there's, like, a walls all around the outside of the gym, and then the rake seating above that.
Yeah.
Like, it literally feels like I've been thrown to the lions, and I'm in the Thunderdome. You know,
yeah,
I'm down there, and I've got 1,100 grade 11s. It's the Friday afternoon of a long weekend at 2 o'clock. The teachers have literally checked out and are all smoking out back, and they've left me with the little bastards. 1,100 of them on Friday afternoon for an hour with a microphone that that keeps on crapping out every 20 minutes for, you know, for about 30 seconds, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, all
right. It's the internet.
So, you know, if you can make it through that,
yeah,
without self-imploding or shitting your pants or running out the side door of the gymnasium, if you can manage to hold even 80% of their attention, then stepping into the soft seat theater with 200 consenting adults who've paid $25 at a writer's festival to hear you talk about whatever, you know, blowhard opinions you're about to, you know, set forth, that's a cakewalk.
Yeah.
No offense.
Yeah.
It's a cakewalk. So, you know, I think one of the reasons that I think I've honed my skills by doing those high school shows, and, you know, sometimes I get, like, really nice writers come up and say, you know, I hear you do a lot of work in high schools, and I think I'd like to, you know, I might, like, how would I get started on, you know, that?
Yeah.
And, doing some, and I, like, you know, I kind of, sometimes I want to go, like, all right, let's just save everyone a lot of pain here. And let me just tell you that they would eat you alive, because you've got about 45 seconds. Maybe a minute at the beginning for them to decide whether they're going to pop their other earbud in, right? And or pull their cell phone out and, you know, and yeah. So they are two very different audiences at the same time as there's a lot of crossover, you know, like the Writers Festival.
Mm-hmm.
They bring in grade 11 and 12s, but they bring in English classes. They bring in creative writing classes. Bring in kids who are engaged, and even in the worst, you know, I'm thinking back to some of the worst high school shows, and I mean, I've been doing them for 17 years, so, you know, I've literally had times where I've had to, like, sort of metaphorically nail my own sneakers to the stage to keep myself from, seriously, I'm not kidding you, I've had times where I've, like, sat there in the back of my, I'm doing it, I'm going through the motions, I'm telling the story, but the whole time I'm, like, questioning every decision I've made as an adult that's resulted in me standing.
Why am I here,
Fort St. John, like, the Thursday before the Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving or the Easter long weekend,
yeah.
you know, going like, you know, I should have stayed in school. I should have done, I should have been an electrician. Like, why am I just driving all the way back from Fort St. John, promising myself I'll never Chetwynd.
Oh, yeah.
The last time I put the high school in Chetwynd in my rearview mirror, I promised myself that I wouldn't even stop for tax.
You'll never go back.
And I haven't. Yeah. I've filled up jerry cans in Prince George, so I didn't have to stop for gas in Chetwynd again. And I haven't. I've kept my word to myself on that one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then every time I, you know, and then you'll have a high school show that'll just blow you away. Or I'll get a letter. I'll get a letter from one of those kids 3 years later.
Yeah.
And
you,
and like all on the edge activities, there the adrenaline rush at the end, there's always a little payoff there, you know?
Yeah. And, the beautiful moments in Rebent Center where you talk about kids that come up to you and talk to you. I mean, I could bring up an example, but people ought to read the book because I can't do it justice in repeating some of the anecdotes in the book. Because
you're very kind, Joe.
You're literally changing lives. Sometimes you don't, but I mean, it's meant something to you in that moment that you decided to write about it later, right?
Yeah. And I collect those moments, the manuscript I'm working on right now is a whole manuscript just of letters. It's just correspondence. And it's called Care Of. Remember how you used to write Care Of?
And envelopes, yeah.
Yeah. There's several letters from kids in high school. Some of them who have written me as much as 7 years later. From a kid who graduated from high school and 7 years later had written me. There's another beautiful letter from a kid whose mom, a trans kid, he was 14 at the time. He's 20 now. And he wrote me 7 years later after his mom had driven him 3 hours to go see me read at a university campus in Monterey Bay, California. I guess all coming down to something that I've always believed with every bit of me, which is how much power there is in personal narrative and story, and how much power there is in stopping, taking the time to listen to each other too, I guess, you know?
And I think I'm going to steal this line from you. I think you wrote this somewhere, that more than ever in this time, our stories matter.
I mean, absolutely. You know, I guess we're far enough in now that we have enough time to reflect on this new reality, mm-hmm. to have time to start to think about what we've learned,
mm-hmm.
and that's definitely one of the big takeaways for me, is how much that kind of human connection has meant in my life, and how quickly I you know, as exhausted as I was when the pandemic first hit, and I was, mm-hmm. I was, in retrospect, I realize I've been full on, like, medically burnt out for probably 2 or 3 years minimum.
Yeah.
And I'm just now starting to really feel like I've gotten, but even still in all that exhaustion, it was immediate and it was visceral how much I missed that human connection that my work has brought into my life in so many ways, but whether that be high school gigs or the book signing table at festivals or theater shows or, you know, just the experience of being on the road. And somebody just asked me in an interview, I think it was on Thursday, about, you know, how much I talk to strangers and how much that's in my work and how none of us talk to strangers anymore.
Yeah.
And how I must really be missing that. I was like, yeah, I definitely talk to fewer strangers, but like, you know, woe be the person stuck in the lineup at the grocery store 6 feet in front of me or 6 feet behind me these days, because, you know, believe me, I'm still out there talking to strangers. I'm just staying a little bit farther away.
Yeah.
And people are not as, obviously, I mean, we're not as friendly or open to each other anymore.
You can't even smile anymore because you got a mask on, right?
Yeah, you can't read people's body language or I'm learning the eye smiling, though. You know, you can.
There's a word for that.
Is there?
Yeah, smize, I think. It comes from, from the, it's a modeling thing, I think. Or it might be from RuPaul, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh, smize, yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm working on the eye smiling.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've just taken the talking to strangers, it's just, my bubble's a little bit smaller. So I know all the neighbors now in Sarah's little townhouse complex.
Yeah, uh-huh.
I know all the people at the dog park, like that, you know.
So, what does after all of this, which is a phrase that I read from you recently? What does after all of this look like? I mean, do you have a sense of how the story ends? Say.
No, I mean, how could any of us really, you know? I don't know. I don't know when. You know, Sarah's a musician, my partner. I don't know when touring is going to happen or what it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when the next time anyone's going to think it's a good idea to cram 800 high school kids into a gymnasium together on the bleachers,
mm-hmm.
If ever, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just keeping my head down, and I'm grateful for this job at Western University right now to help us pay the bills for the next little while. And trying to get some work done and trying to glean whatever joy I can out of online gigs.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I do know that I don't think I want to go back to being on the road 220 days out of every calendar year.
Wow.
But which is how it was going for about the last decade for me.
Yeah.
And I don't know. How about you? Like, what are you thinking? I call it the after, capital T, capital A.
Yeah. I guess I'm optimistic enough to think that something good will come out of all of this. It changes every day, obviously, my enthusiasm, my optimism, I should say, because of, you know, what's happening around us. I don't know. I generally think that we as people are generally adaptable. We like to think we're not. We like to think we're rigid and you know we know ourselves well enough that I think we will adapt. And at this point, I can only hope that it'll be to better things. You know, I mean, I'm reading a lot, and you know, it's incredibly edifying. But again, yeah, it doesn't replace, you know, the interaction that, you know, I mean, I have a relationship with your work, but I mean, that it's not like sitting down and talking to you on a Saturday afternoon like we are now.
Yeah.
So I'm fortunate in that sense that I'm able to do that with you. You know, some of your other readers, Oh, I guess they can write you, right?
Yeah, they can write me, and I'll have for the near future anyway.
Yeah.
I'll have time to write them back. I think I want to keep up with the skipping. I really, you know, and everybody's like, you know, I've talked about it on social media a bit. People, you know, the writer Michael Winter, he wrote me, and he's like, you know, what kind of rope are you using? Is it weighted? Is it, you know, does it have ball bearings? And we've tried out several, and I'm happy to say that the $14 jobby we got at Canadian Tire, the plastic, that's my favorite, and it's also the smallest and the lightest, so that's...
Oh, you can take it anywhere, yeah.
If I ever do go back on the road again, you're going to see me skipping in a hotel parking lot near you.
Yeah.
Just this chance to slow the roll. I had time to watch the garden, you know,
grow,
spring and summer, and I can't even tell you how much daily joy I got out of that. I would come home from the road in the before and just be glad if my plants weren't dead, you know. Just be grateful that my neighbor managed to stumble her way in there every 3 or 4 days and water them and keep them from completely extinguishing themselves. And this spring I watched it. I didn't even know what they were when they first came out of the ground because I never planted the garden here in London.
Yeah.
But what's those? Oh, and I look up the leaf. Oh, it's a peony. I wonder if any... Oh, and there's a bulb. Wow. And then ants were crawling all over the bulb, you know. And I thought, oh, is that bad? Like, do I do something? Do I spray the ants off with it? And I looked it up, and no, ants actually feed on a sugar that's secreted by the peony bulb. It's a part of that actually helps them open.
And then it helps them grow, yeah.
Yeah, they just turned into these almost incredible. The flowers were so big, they almost toppled themselves. And,
wow.
Yeah, and I've collected up some seed pods and given some to the neighbors and planted some in the front garden beds now.
Yeah.
And dried them out proper. And hopefully we're going to have a propagation of peonies next spring. And I don't know. I'll never forget those days in May, all of a sudden realizing that I had time to literally get up in the morning and see how much taller the spirea bush was than it was the day before. And learn all the names of the birds at the bird feeder, because they got very different birds in Ontario than I'm used to in the Yukon and the
Sea. Yeah.
All kinds of critters that I wasn't familiar with. And orioles, that's an incredible bird to see, an oriole.
They're orange, right?
Yeah, they're orange. Yeah. And I always really fancied a blue jay, you know, and that's a rare. I don't think I ever saw it in the Yukon, but they're quite common out here. Turns out they're kind of bullies.
Oh,
actually, they're not kind of bullies. They're terrible bullies. They'll boss everybody off the bird feeder. They eat babies out of other birds' nests, and they're kind of terrible, but still pretty.
But the blue must be something that you've never seen,
Yeah. I think, ironically, the blue jays are the hockey player of the bird world, you know. And they're the kind of enforcer of the bird world, you know, the enforcer hockey player. They're the Tiger Williams of the bird world.
Yeah.
And anyway, I won't go on about it. But
I could talk all afternoon with you, but I have to let you go.
Okay, Joe.
But it is so. I'm looking forward to these events at the Writers Fest and being able to see you as you know one can online, but my thanks for taking the time to chat, because it's always fun. And
anytime, Joe. And thank you for all your support over especially the last couple of books. It doesn't go unnoticed, and I'm definitely grateful for it.
Well, you're very welcome. But and for people listening to us, they ought to pick up. Well, Tomboy Survival Guide is a remarkable piece of writing. Reben Sinner is also that. And you know, two in a row like that are just. And the other thing I want to mention just before I let you go, I have very many happy memories from a year or so ago, when you, me, and Teresa Kishkan were on a panel that judged the Hubert Evans Prize. I will never forget the interactions we had on email and the discussion we had about books. I found that just remarkable. It really was, for me, a great honor to have my name with the both of you on in terms of handing out that prize. So I want to mention that to you.
I already knew this about you, but if there was anything that cemented the knowledge in my head about you, it was reading 102 nonfiction titles over, 3 months?
Yeah.
That you are an exceptionally careful reader, and that is, that's a grand skill.
You're very kind. The funny thing, after doing that, I told Sean Cranberry this, that there were books I didn't like that you could not help but think they were exceptional pieces of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were books that I liked, really yeah. liked, even that I'd read even before the I was going to be on the I knew I was going to be on the panel, that once I looked at again seriously, were not that good. But I mean, it didn't take away the fact that I liked them and would recommend them to people. Say, but mm-hmm. I guess you just you it is subjective. But then at the same time, you can be objective as a you know someone sitting on a panel like that.
Yeah, the interesting thing was that I remember the day in April when remember you had to fill out the little form pick your top five books, and I literally went the email made that noise.
Yeah.
And then my phone went ding dong, and there was a courier at the front door. It's hooked up to my cell phone, and five more cases of books.
Oh yeah, because you went on to judge.
I was on the Hillary Weston jury. There was literally less than 15 seconds expired before when I sent off the results. But I will tell you this: I learned more from doing those two back-to-back juries, 102 titles, I think it was, and 99 or 100 titles for the Hillary Weston Prize. Yeah. But I gave myself all of 2020. I got asked to be on a bunch of juries this year, too, and I said, no, I need to concentrate on my own work this year. Because, it was like a crash course in nonfiction that I'll never forget.
Yeah.
2019 was,
Well, keep well, and I say that selfishly because I can't wait to read whatever's next. So,
I guess I'll see you next week online.
Online, indeed,
Yeah, there will be no prawns, though. And let the record show I feel ripped off.
Well, there's always the year after, you know, after all of this, right?
Yes, in the after.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks, Ivan.
Yep, thanks for your time.
The website's for more, ivancoyote.com, and of course, writersfest.bc.ca. Ivan Coyote joined me on the line from London, Ontario, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.